prevent people entering the country as evangelicals in order to carry out illegal activities such as money laundering. The problem is not exclusive to Nicaragua, but is affecting the whole continent, said Pastor Sorno, before confirming the measures will apply to both foreign evangelical pastors as well as those from the Catholic Church.
Bolivia's Minister of the Presidency, Juan Ramón Quintana, has accused the opposition and sectors of the national media of plotting to destabilize the government, saying that the country was going through a war of lies. In a strongly worded interview on the program The People on the state radio channel, during which he promoted his book Bolivia Leaks, Minister Quintana called leaders of the opposition lackeys and buffoons who campaigned to destroy the country seeking to receive funding from the United States. This gentleman of this cartel of lies, said the ministers in reference to the opposition, are commissioned to feed a program of destabilization that points to the U.S. government. The Evo Morales administration recently questioned meetings between the U.S. Church d'Affaires in Bolivia and leaders of the right-wing opposition.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
On the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
The hemisphere is now solid with respect to Cuba. 19 of the 20 nations have broken diplomatic relations. The foreign ministers of the hemisphere have now applied all of the, what might be called, the peaceful remedies under the Rio Treaty. Castro's course is not the path of the future. This was illustrated in Brazil, where tendencies moving in the Castro direction were called to a halt very quickly by the those who believed in a constitutional democracy in that country, the Congress, the governors, the armed forces.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligence Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian Land! Indian Land! Indian Land! Indian Land! You guys have no jurisdiction here. Indian Land!
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians over the land, all say the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for the smart of the region.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
My first job in the CIA after the training program was over was to do name checks for all of the prospective name checks of all of the prospective Venezuelan employees of the Creole Petroleum Company. Name checks means that a name is taken, and in this case I got all of these names from our office in Caracas, Venezuela, and I would check the names against all of the CIA files, which are computerized and mechanized, searching for possible indications of left-wing political sympathies or membership. On those that I found data, I would send that back to Caracas, where it would be turned over to the Creole office in Caracas, and those people wouldn't be hired. It's worth saying that the Creole Petroleum Company is one of the principal subsidiaries abroad of the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, Exxon, which, as we all know, is a pillar of the Rockefeller family fortune. This is a specific example of the CIA assisting outright a multinational corporation. But in general terms, everything that the CIA is doing in the propaganda area and in the political warfare area tends in one way or another to help create the optimum operating conditions for multinational corporations in that particular country.
Following the Bay of Pigs, there was a considerable new effort throughout Latin America to head off what was called the export of the Castro Revolution. And we were engaged in this from the Rio Grande to Tierra del Fuego, the foot of Argentina.
As far as the United States is concerned, the encouragement and support of subversion by the Castro regime against other countries of this hemisphere is not a subject for bargaining. It simply must stop.
At any one time, down in Latin America, in Ecuador, we had on our payroll or in an intimate working relationship with our station one vice president, a president of the Chamber of Deputies, a president of the Senate, a vice president of the Senate, a number of senators, a number of deputies, the Secretary General of the Democratic Socialist Party. We even created a party down there, which we called the Popular Revolutionary Liberal Party, which would appeal to a lot of different people. We had extensive propaganda operations during this period also. The outstanding liberal columnist of the country, Gustavo Salgado, who wrote for El Comercio, which was one of the principal dailies, under pen names, working for us, writing up our material and publishing it as if it were his own. We would publish small notices, which would be practically hysterical outcries against the growth of communism in Ecuador, or a specific issue such as the visit of diplomats from some communist country. Our participation consisted in creating the conditions of fear and at times hysteria with regard to the growth of the left-wing political organizations in Ecuador, such as the communist organizations, and the fear with regard to the influence of the Cuban Revolution. Our themes were the threat of these developments to traditional Ecuadorian values. And when I speak of Ecuador, I am speaking of most of the rest of Latin America too, the family, religion, and tradition, essentially.
President, when you were in Argentina, you had developed a relationship with the producer of the Argentine newsreel. And could you mention how that worked? Yeah.
Well, what we did in that instance was take stories, news stories regarding world events, Russian activities or U.S. activities regarding Cuba and Cuban activities in Latin America, and we would twist the story so that it would have a context, perhaps, or sometimes an explicit statement of information which was really not true, but which supported the position that we had. This was the way the news was presented. We worked in a commentary that presented the slant that we wanted.
The use of forged documents and false documents is another area in which the CIA can
bring about a very timely effect. In Ecuador, for example, we at one point wanted to expose the preparations for guerrilla activity of a particular organization, and while one of its leaders was in Cuba on a trip, we wrote up what would appear to be, the way we wrote it, his report to the Cubans. We put this report in a toothpaste tube. This was planted in his luggage when he returned on this trip and discovered by our people in the Treasury Ministry, and he was immediately thrown into jail. And when the report was finally published in the newspapers, it caused a sensation all across the country. We were able to force the Ecuadorian government to break relations with Cuba, and at the same time we were able to promote repression of left-wing political organizations, eventually establishing a military junta which took over in July of 1963.
When I was in Argentina, the most interesting thing we had to do regarding Castro was to drum up support on the part of the Argentine government for the Venezuelan charge that Castro was supplying guerrillas in Venezuela with arms. The arm cache was found in November 1963. I had served, before going down to Argentina, as Venezuelan desk officer. And I was surprised that one of the things that was developed as proof was a series of statements by some man who had been captured back at the time when I was desk officer. And somehow, these arms were supposed to be delivered 2 years later, supposed to be tied in with an urban guerrilla plot that he confessed to. Well, in the first place, everybody who becomes a prisoner of the security police in Latin America usually confesses, and knowing what our directives were and what we had to do to try to convince the Argentines of this, I have some suspicion about the reality of this arms cache as a Cuban operation. I think it might well have been planted by us.
Let us say to our brothers in Venezuela, we are with you in full solidarity and will act with you to ensure the safety of your democracy.
Venezuela did get its resolution condemning Castro passed by the OAS, and Castro was ostracized economically and politically from the rest of the hemisphere, which of course was the major objective of Kennedy's policy toward Cuba.
The hemisphere is now solid with respect to Cuba. 19 of the 20 nations have broken diplomatic relations. The foreign ministers of the hemisphere have now applied all of the, what might be called, the peaceful remedies under the Rio Treaty. Castro's course is not the path of the future. This was illustrated in Brazil, where tendencies moving in the Castro direction were called to a halt very quickly by the those who believed in a constitutional democracy in that country, the Congress, the governors, the armed forces.
Communism and democracy is going to be finally settled not in the councils of diplomats or by the heads of government, but in the hearts and the minds, yes, in the stomachs of the multitudes of the ordinary working people of Asia, of Africa, of Europe, yes, and of the Americas too. The voice of our America, which can speak most clearly and persuasively to these people, is the voice of American labor, of the AFL-CIO.
I got a call from Washington if I would be interested in a position in Latin America. Well, to me, here's a little man coming out of the ghettos. I felt it was a big opportunity. I didn't even know where Latin America was at that time.
Who called you from Washington?
Tom Robles. See, Tom Robles and I had been friends here. Tom Robles was the secretary of the State FFL CIO in those years. Very strong man, very strong labor man. Had a lot of guts in those years. And he was instrumental in my being called to Washington to be interviewed for this particular position in Brazil. My position was going to be administrator and organizer for the Postal Telegraph Telephone International, which was later on I learned that it was one of these phony organizations under the CIA. My boss was Wallace Leggy, who was one of John McCone's top hands. John McCone at that time was the head of the CIA.
In August of 1960, when we came to a full realization as to what had happened to the Cuban workers and the entire Cuban people under Castro, the AFL-CIO appropriated $20,000 for the purpose of studying the establishment of a mechanism through which we would help to strengthen the free labor unions of Latin America and develop trade union leadership.
CIA's trade union operations are effective through a vast bureaucracy of people. These are the officers of the international trade unions and of the national unions, especially in the United States, through which the CIA is able to infiltrate and manipulate the international unions. Of course, Mr. Meany has been in the past one of the principal, if not the principal, U.S. trade unionist through which these operations are effected.
I'm Andy McClellan. I'm the inter-American representative of the AFL-CIO and have been since 1964. Prior to that time, I was the associate inter-American representative. And prior to that time, I was inter-American representative of the International Union of Food and Allied Workers, based in Geneva, but working in Latin America.
I'm the executive director of the American Institute for Free Labor Development. Prior to that time, as a matter of fact, I've been the executive director now for some 10 years, and I've been with the American Institute for Free Labor Development since its founding in 1962. For the period immediately prior to 1962, I was the inter-American representative of the Postal Telegraph and Telephone International, which has headquarters in Switzerland, but I was their representative in the Western Hemisphere.
Didn't they tell you what you were going to be doing in the labor movement in Brazil?
The idea was Well, they don't explain anything. You go there with the impression that you are going there to do a labor job to represent the membership. This was my impression of. They didn't tell me otherwise. So I started tackling the problems, combating the management for better conditions, working conditions, higher salaries, lenient rules. What you do in the labor movement? Apparently, I was doing the wrong thing because 3 months later, I was through a courier that was sent to Brazil where I had to go travel for about 4 or 5 hours, go all over the city to meet this guy who was just across the street from my office. But they wanted to make sure that there weren't any enemies following me. So then they instructed me that I was to return to Washington. That was in November, shortly before Thanksgiving, and go
what
for...
Year?
That was in 1962, same year that I started there, to be trained on clandestine activities. Leggy pointed out to me that we were organizing for 1964. See, and he was reorganizing his forces in D.C. He was ahead of the whole PTTI operation then. And he says, Richard, look, we're organizing against the communists for 1964. So your job is to organize within the your field as a communicator to organize against the communists. Later on, after I got trained in New York, I felt, well, it was a brainwash type of thing. I became a very fanatic. I was a real fanatic then.
There have been some people who have accused the AFL-CIO of collaborating with the CIA, and what would be your response to that accusation?
I think that is so ridiculous and so infantile, so juvenile, to make such an accusation.
And you, Mr. Dougherty?
Well, I agree. I don't know of any labor leader that wouldn't out-and-out deny such an accusation. It's just not true.
In Latin America, one of the principal and most effective of the trade unionists, of the American trade unionists who worked with us, was Bill Dougherty. He had originally started in the Post Telegraph and Telephone Workers International, coming up through the Communications Workers of America. Later on, he was transferred into the American Institute for Free Labor Development. This was set up during the Kennedy period and is a joint effort by American trade unionists like George Meany and the heads of American-based multinational corporations which operate in Latin America. The cover for this type of activity is indeed education and social projects, such as the development of cooperatives and housing. But the real reason is to create cadres of organizers who, after their training in the AIFLD is over, they can go back to their industries and spend 1 year or 2 years or even longer doing nothing but organizing.
And this is the 75th class that has graduated from Front Royal from the time that we started the programs out there. This particular group has been studying democratic trade unionism. It is our hope that they will go back to their respective countries and put into practice some of the things that they have learned while they were here at Front Royal.
Concluding our luncheon today, and wishing you, not only in my name, but in the name of President George Meany of the AFL-CIO,
honorándoles no solamente en nombre mío, sino en nombre del presidente George Meany de la AFL-CIO,
I'd like to leave you a thought in Spanish.
Quisiera dejarles con un pensamiento en español.
That comes from one of the great political and one of the great literary geniuses of this century and of the past century in Latin America.
Idea de uno de los grandes grandes figuras políticas y literarias de este siglo.
The true liberator of his country.
El auténtico libertador de su país.
From heaven, who is embarrassed by the shame that now exists in Cuba because of the dictatorship of Fidel Castro.
Cielo, que pase vergüenzas por la dictadura que actualmente existe en la Cuba de Fidel Castro.
That great Cuban José Martí one time said.
Ese gran cubano José Martí una vez dijo.
El mundo se divide en dos ramos.
The world is divided into two camps.
Los que aman y construyen.
Those who love and build.
Los que odian y destruyen.
And those who hate and destroy.
Nosotros, compañeros sindicalistas libres, somos que amamos y construimos. Váyanse con Dios, compañeros.
We are the lovers and builders.
Go with God.
These institutes that were created by the AFL-CIO as their major instrument and vehicles now for international work has on its boards of directors prominent American employers. For instance, the American Institute for Free Labor Development in Latin America has for many years had as chairman of its board one Peter Grace. And if one looks at the long list of corporations that initially contributed to the establishment of the AFL's American Institute for Free Labor Development, it includes not only United Fruit, but Anaconda Copper, and a whole string of U.S. corporations that have never voluntarily accepted their obligation to pay decent wages and provide good working conditions in the United States. They always had to be forced to do it through union organization and strike action, etc. And why suddenly these corporate interests now should be embraced as allies and be foisted on Latin American labor or any other American labor groups, any other Latin American labor groups, as people with credentials suitable for picking future trade union leaders and training them, this is beyond my imagination.
We'll spend the first 9 months yet to get back instructing other people in our branch institutes in Latin America. And what they do after that 9 months is over, I can't say, but if they join some political party that's against the regime in power, I think it's stretching your imagination quite a bit if you're going to attribute that to what the AIFLD done while they were up here.
We were supposed to get the revolution going by May of 1964. I would call my leadership and I tell them, look, this is what we have to do. We have to get the people on our side because the communists have a bigger membership than we do. So you have to go out there and pull the membership away from them. See, and this is where the idea of training our leadership to go to Front Royal came into being.
This is J. Peter Grace, and he says here, AIFLD men also helped drive communists from control of British Guiana. They prevented the communists from taking over powerful unions in Honduras and helped to drive the communists from strong jugular unions in Brazil. Could you go back to that period and sort of describe what the atmosphere was in Latin America?
We were living in the early 60s, I think, Andy, you would agree with me, in an era when we were in the streets battling for the lives of the free trade union movement against what was then a more powerful communist trade union movement that since then, in my estimation, has lost an awful lot of its appeal and its attraction and its ability to maneuver.
I was doing just exactly what Bill Doherty had done all for years and years in Brazil, see, not only in Brazil, but all over the country, all over the Latin American countries. So Bill Doherty now heading the AIFLD was the same type of operation. You know? Go around buying people. So I would recommend maybe 6, 7, 8 people, which were good potentials as labor organizers, and I would put them on a plane, send them down to Front Royal. They would be paid there. They got their lodging, their meals, the whole works. And then I would support their families in Brazil.
And was this part of the preparation for what happened in 1964?
That was the object of the whole thing.
A half a world away, troops are called out in the suburbs of Rio de Janeiro to quell rioting over President João Goulart's attempts to form a new Brazilian government after the resignation of Prime Minister Tancredo Neves and his cabinet. Food stores are looted as dealers hold back supplies of beans, rice, and other staples because they feel government price controls are set too low. Order is restored, but not before 11 persons are killed and a crippling general strike is called over the power struggle between the president and the parliament of Brazil.
Says Mr. Doherty, quote, "What happened in Brazil on April 1st did not just happen, it was planned, and planned months in advance. Many of the trade union leaders, some of whom were actually trained in our institute, were involved in the revolution and in the overthrow of the Goulart regime."
Immediately prior to the military takeover in Brazil, there was a group of students from Brazilian unions in training in Front Royal. This wasn't the first of the Brazilian groups that have been here, nor has it been the last. We've had them continuously. They weren't in any kind of a course training for revolutionary activities or clandestine activities. They were in a regular collective bargaining course. It so happens that when many of those students went back home from that course, their unions were involved in this struggle against the attempt of the communists to take over some of the unions, and that's precisely what I meant by the statement.
I can say to you categorically now that it is not true. Well, under no circumstances have we ever received or solicited any money from the CIA.
It doesn't say that the AFL-CIO received it. The $33 million doesn't go to the AFL-CIO. It goes to the AIFLD.
Let me state that these unions you mentioned have stated just as categorically as I have that they do not receive and have not received CIA money.
The communists are going to accuse anything that is effective as being CIA, because I think the CIA and the communist KGB have long been involved in an international struggle. The truth of the matter is that our books are now and always have been open to the public. Our government funds are appropriated by the Congress. The congressional committees have completely all total access to them.
I was keeping books and everything else where all my expenses were going. And they came to me, they sent a curio, and they said, you know, we understand you have books and everything else, you know. And I said, how in the hell do you know? We know what you're doing, huh? We don't want you to keep books. We don't want you to keep any records at all. Because what would happen if the communists would raid your office, huh? Then they would know who's getting money from us, you know, what you're spending money on and everything else. As long as you show results, We don't care what you do with the money. So I used to travel with briefcases full of money. Hello?
Didn't you also use that money, for example, to buy weaponry?
No. I didn't, because my field workers did that. They did that actually on their own. No? They were aware of the fact that we were having a revolution. No? And the day was going to come.
An exiled Brazilian colonel had this to say. In 1961, the CIA started an internal preparation for a military coup. First, they created a propaganda network with specialized personnel. And these people attempted to exploit all of the government errors and difficulties. And in the meanwhile, they spread disinformation and they created slogans which had nothing to do with the real situation. And all of this was to prove to the broad masses of people that Brazil was on its way to communism and that democracy had to be defended. So they organized COMDE, the Women's Campaign for Democracy. And they directed this principally at women, playing on the feeling that women mainly have for the family and religion.
We began these so-called marches for God and peace, the so-called pots and pan demonstration. We talked in terms of hundreds of thousands, say, demonstrating in Rio and in Sao Paulo. And I think it was the women that obliged the military to move in and take over. That happened in Chile 10 years later. Almost the whole scenario was the same, which leads one to believe that there may have been some Brazilian advisors, or some Brazilian advisors, in Chile at the same time, fomenting the revolution against the Allende.
On the day before the coup, Castelo Branco, who was then the chief of the Army General Staff, could not make up his mind. He wasn't sure that the coup would be successful. General Vernon Walter personally went to tell him that, yes, he should join the coup because, in case it was needed, the American fleet and naval task force was sailing close to the coast of Espiritu Santo, where the Marines would land to support the coup forces. And it was for this reason that Castelo Branco decided to support the coup.
Anti-Goulart demonstrations that greeted the now-deposed Brazilian president at Miami Airport when he was en route to take office in 1961 show the deep distrust that has finally led to his downfall and exile in Uruguay. Troops had to be called out in Brasilia to quell the bitter protests of thousands against the notoriously left-leaning João Goulart's taking office. A Russian trade show in Rio de Janeiro gave President Goulart, who paradoxically is a millionaire rancher, a chance to hobnob with some of his Soviet heroes. But it was his sympathies with nearer at hand Fidel Castro that the Brazilians really feared. Riotings against Goulart were frequent. Yet when the end of his regime came, it was through a brief and bloodless military coup. What his successors can do with the almost totally wrecked economy he leaves behind him is a matter of concern to the entire Western Hemisphere.
Did you have arms stashed right there in your office?
Yeah, they were right there in my closet, yeah.
What kind of weapons were they?
Should name it. Machine guns, all types of weapons. Huh?
Did your field workers participate at all in that coup? What'd they do?
They burnt up the communist headquarters. They burnt up the whole damn building. My own people. All I knew was that the communists had been put away in prisons. The military had brought in ships, put them in the bay, and confined the communists, you know, put them in ships, locked the doors and thrown the keys away and whatever.
So were a lot of communists in the labor movement there that you knew about in jail?
There were more of them than us. More.
And they were all jailed?
They were all thrown in jail.
I remember my family was very much against the Goulart government. They were very happy with the coup. The coup did answer the middle class's earnings for better order and against the inflation. I mean, the middle classes were quite prepared for that kind of thing, that Goulart was bringing communism, and communism would bring down family, property, and no more order, law. And that's where my family, more or less, very typically of the rest. I was in the secondary movement, secondary students movement. Little by little, I started getting closer and closer to the people on the left. In 65, 66, and 67, the student movement was the first one to start reorganizing again. There were many different demonstrations against the government, but one of them in early March 68, they were protesting for a better restaurant, and a student was killed. And that sparked the whole chain of demonstrations, and more people got killed, and more demonstrations, because by then, the petty bourgeoisie that in 64 was for the coup started suffering because of the coup. The military government brought in a lot of repression. People started actually being arrested and taken to court and being tortured.
The police program began on a large scale under Dwight Eisenhower. He felt there was a need to train the police to help with the fighting of communism after the Second World War. He recruited for the purpose a man named Byron Engel. Byron Engel was, by the time he came into this program, a member of the CIA. After the Bay of Pigs, Engel's program was much expanded. Police from around the world were brought and trained by U.S. advisors. The training was to make them more efficient, but a third of the training was given over in one way or another to make them aware of the communist menace and to go back into their countries to fight communism.
Immediately when you're arrested, you have to tell your house, you have, we're supposed to, they force you, they try to force you to tell what where you live, who, other addresses you know, where you meet, because that's where they get their information from. The situation is so difficult that they dare not put infiltrators. They have not courage nor possibility of actually infiltrating the left. It's too dangerous. So the only way they get their information is through torture.
Whenever one could get the information about a specific high-ranking official in torture, not one of these men off the street, but a man who had based his career on his ability to extract information from political prisoners. In the cases that I investigated, I found that they had been trained at a United States base.
Well, they started asking some questions, they wouldn't say anything, and then they started immediately torturing me after the doctor left. And, I mean, it's the same story of so many people. It's torture, electric shocks, and beatings and telephones, and finally it's a few hours like that.
Many of the people I spoke with, exiles, political exiles in Europe, had been tortured with U.S. Army field telephones. They were simple, they were easy to operate, and we had sent them in large numbers as part of our military assistance plan. You hook up wires to the telephone, and you put one wire perhaps on a man's penis and another in his mouth. When they're put in the mouth, the torturer uses a rubber glove. This is done with a certain degree of surgical precision. There is no embarrassment among the torturers, I was told, about the handling of genitals. Although when women are tortured, oftentimes the higher-ranking officials will find an excuse to come by and watch the torture.
I decided that I would confirm everything they wanted. It was in such a condition. They certainly wouldn't settle for less. and I didn't want to go through any more torture. I was ideologically, I was weak enough to say, if they know, why not?
What we brought to it, what we as the United States, through our efficient system brought, was the sense that you used only the amount of torture appropriate to get information. And the reason torture persists is that although the cant among the police officers is that torture is not an effective way to get information, it of course is.
The torture is a necessity of the system, not because some minds, sick minds think of it, but because the resistance continues to grow. It's a sporadic thing, small form, but it's always there. Torture is the answer to that.
We were unsuccessful in our efforts to weaken the left in Uruguay during the period when I was in Uruguay, 1964 to 1966. Our job, in the face of the growth of the strength of the left during that period, was to promote repression. It was the only alternative we had. In 1966, we brought in a CIA officer who set up his office in the police department under the cover of the public safety mission of AID. This officer was to work exclusively with the police intelligence, trying to improve its capabilities. This officer was still there in 1970 at the time that the American public safety mission chief, Dan Mitrione, was kidnapped and executed by the Tupamaros.
Was the small city cop in Richmond, Indiana. He had advanced to the position of chief of police and had heard about Byron Engel's program in Washington, applied, and of course he was exactly the sort of person they were looking for to send abroad. Diligent, hardworking.
Dan exemplified the highest principles of the police profession, that of social service. He served in Brazil for 7 years, at the International Police Academy in Washington for 2, and in Montevideo for 1. There are 250 million people in Latin America. In many of these countries, the communist terrorists are trying to tear the fabric of democracy apart. Some of these countries, Uruguay among them, realize that the best protection against this is the development of a democratic police, and have asked the United States to help. And this is what Dan was doing in Uruguay.
Mitrione was a tough professional by 1969. He had spent 9 years in the program. He had been in Brazil, where there had been a great deal of repression and refinement of torture as an interrogation technique. And he went to Uruguay to get information.
Some time ago, an officer of the Uruguayan armed forces made this photograph public. This testimony is from Dr. Hugo Villar, who is an Uruguayan exile. He said, "Here you see an almost naked prisoner with a hood. Practically all of the prisoners are hooded, which is a measure taken so that they cannot identify their torturer." Daniel Mitrione, efficient-looking, congenial in manner. This is the testimony of Manuel Evilla, an AID official from 1964 to 1970 in Uruguay. He's testifying about Mitrione. He says, "Mitrione was a perfectionist. He supervised every detail. He insisted on checking everything. During the training sessions, he directed and personally executed each aspect." This question of perfectionism, he insisted on an economy of effort. He used to say, "Precise pain in the precise place at the precise time. You must be careful. You should avoid excesses." Another phrase of his was this: "Remember that the death of the person interrogated constitutes a failure of the technician," because that's what he considered himself, a technician.
One of the pieces of equipment that had been found useful was a wire so very thin that it could be fitted into the mouth between the teeth, and by pressing against the gums increased the electrical charge. And it was through the diplomatic pouches that Mitrione got some of the equipment he needed for the interrogations, including these fine wires.
Several street beggars were picked up whose disappearance would attract no attention. This was the technique that Mitrione had developed, or rather perfected, in Brazil before coming to Uruguay. Using these beggars, experiments were conducted with different forms of interrogation, letting the students see the effects of different voltages on different parts of the human body, male and female. All these unhappy people died without really knowing why they were undergoing this pain, without even having the possibility of answering any question, because they were not asked any questions. They were simply guinea pigs.
In Los Fresnos, Texas, the CIA ran for the police program a school in the construction of bombs. Students came from around the world, particularly Latin America. They were instructed in the manufacture of plastic, homemade bombs to destroy radio stations, automobiles. Dan Mitrione sent students from Uruguay to that school. They came from all over Latin America. The idea was that you had to be particularly trustworthy, and you were pledged not to talk about any of the activities, but the courses were run by CIA personnel.
The death squads were very active in 1972 or 1973. This was denounced in the Uruguayan Congress before the Congress was dissolved, and it was mainly denounced when the Tupamaros kidnapped one of the main leaders, one of the main heads of the death squad, called Nelson Barbesio. He was a CIA agent. He confessed he was a CIA agent. He was trained in the United States. He was paid by the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States to work. The way they hide his work was he was a photographer. He had a laboratory, but he was organizing all these death squads. He participated in a lot of assassinations and bombings.
Nelson Bardesio was sent to Buenos Aires to train with the Argentinian police. From that trip, he brought back to Montevideo charges of plastic explosive, and that plastic material for bombs was used against political figures on the left by the police, who went around Montevideo in police cars at night, bombing political opponents.
Every CIA station during that period, and I would expect today, was required to maintain what was called the Subversive Control Watch List. This was a list of the most important left-wing political activists in the city or in the country, and the list would include not only their name, but the name of their mother, the name of their father, of their children, of their wife, their address where they lived, the address where they worked, the places they would go with their friends, clubs they might belong to, where they would undertake their leisure activities, everything we might need to know for sudden action against that person. These lists would be usually maintained in the CIA offices and kept up to date, but whenever necessary, they were turned over to the local police or the local military authorities for action on the part of those authorities.
The Uruguayan death squads started acting in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, and some of our best friends and aides were kidnapped and assassinated. The prominent leaders who were kidnapped were Héctor Gutiérrez Ruiz and Senator Selmar Michelini. They were both kidnapped and assassinated the same night. That very night, they went after my father and myself. When we started living in Argentina, we had to register in the police headquarters. And the first 3 or 4 weeks, we lived in an apartment in the street, in a street called Suipacha. Then we moved to the apartment where we lived, you know, where my parents lived for 2 years, and I lived for the last 8 months. And the only place where we had the old address registered was the police headquarters. And it was to our old address where they went after us.
El asesinato de estos líderes políticos de Uruguay.
The murder of these political leaders in Uruguay is actually part of an international campaign, which includes the assassination of the Chilean generals Schneider and Prata. The attempt against Leighton in Europe. The murder of Orlando Letelier, the former Chilean ambassador in the United States. The killing of Torres, the president of Bolivia. As well as the murders of scores of Uruguayan, Chilean, Bolivian, Argentinian, and Brazilian patriots, which has occurred in different parts of America or in Europe, in their country or in other countries. Mitrione's presence and actions in Uruguay do not represent the excesses of a single individual. He went to Uruguay to accomplish a mission, to fulfill a task, to coordinate a part of the advisory program the CIA undertook in the police headquarters in Montevideo. Starting in Mitrione's time, there was a qualitative increase in the tortures, beatings, and killings. The brutality persisted, but he introduced the refinements of modern technology. Next, you will hear the actual voices of Mitrione and his captors.
Well, now tell me something about the CIA.
Well, you know, you're not going to believe me. And no matter what I have to convince you that I tell the truth, I know nothing about the CIA. Absolutely nothing about the CIA.
How do you think the Uruguayan government would behave now, you know?
I hope they bargain with you.
Yes, we hope it too. We don't like you.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I regret all about this, I don't like one thing, and that is too many innocent people suffer.
Yes.
And my wife and children are all there. There's no reason for them to be suffering.
I'm sorry about them, too. I'm sorry about all the families of our fans who are in prison, being tortured or killed.
There are many
innocent people have to suffer.
The government of Uruguay, bolstered by a new policy of Richard Nixon not to deal with revolutionaries, resisted every attempt to exchange political prisoners for Mitrione's life. The result was that a deadline was set some 10 days after he was captured for release of 150 political prisoners or Mitrione would be killed. The government did not respond to that warning. Mitrione's body was found the following day in an abandoned car on a side street in Montevideo.
This callous murder emphasizes the essential inhumanity of the terrorist. The American people join the president in condemning this cold-blooded crime against a defenseless human being. Mr. Mitrione's devoted service to the cause of peaceful progress in an orderly world will remain as an example for free men everywhere.
I wish to emphasize again that the United States government or any of its plots were not involved in this coup attempt in any way or shape. and also that it is our policy to not intervene in the affairs, internal affairs of another country.
American involvement in Chile was almost total. It was pervasive in every sense. The American ambassador in Chile, when I arrived there, was expected to act as a proconsul. Part of that was his legal responsibilities. That is, the Congress, in passing laws governing aid, had made the American ambassador responsible for not only reporting on, but justifying American actions in every sector of human activity that you might think of. These involvements grew out of a covert involvement that had begun in the early 1960s.
From about 1963 to 1973, we gave a lot of assistance, many millions of dollars, to the socialist, center democratic forces in Chile, the Nationalist Party, the Christian Democratic Party, some of the free press, some of the other organizations in Chilean society. And that was designed to strengthen them against Allende's strength, supported by Castro.
Through the CIA, through AID money, through the use of multinationals, a concentrated, coordinated program had been launched out of the White House, the purpose of which was to stop Allende from being elected president of Chile in 1964 and to elect the Christian Democrats and to make of the Christian Democratic experience a model for all of Latin America.
This essentially was the program that CIA conducted. There was one exception to that for a period of about 6 weeks in 1970.
I think we will win because I have profound faith in the political consciousness of the people, despite the inequality of the contending forces in the struggle. But I have absolute faith and confidence in the political awareness of the people and the loyalty of the national majority, which will support the program of the Popular Unity Coalition and its candidate.
During that time, at the direct order of our president, CIA went down to really try to activate a military action against Allende when he was just named as president.
When Allende was elected, there were two things that then happened. On the one hand, there was a public constitutional gimmick thought up by the lame duck Frey government to block Allende from becoming president. And I was ordered in a secret cable on September 15th, 1970, to contact Frey and determine just how far he was going to go in this way, and offered $250,000 at my discretional use in support of this what they described as this constitutional ploy. On that same day, they sent secret instructions to the CIA chief, who was just as upset as anybody on getting these instructions and protested them, to carry out a plot with Chilean dissident military general, retired general, to block Allende's election by any means short of what they call the Dominican-type U.S. Marine invasion, to block his inauguration. And that plot went forward on the specific orders of Nixon behind the back of the State Department and behind my back.
Everybody knew who Allende was because he had been a candidate for so many times before. And everybody knew, especially United States companies, that he was going to nationalize the copper mining. Copper is our main wealth, and it was an irony that it was not in our hands. But that wealth was used to enrich multinational companies.
Mr. McComb, in 1970, did you have occasion to discuss the Chilean presidential elections with Mr. Helms, then director of the Central Intelligence Agency?
Yes, I did.
Did you evidence your concern over the outcome of the Chilean election to Mr. Helms?
It was our opinion, and this had been discussed in the board meeting of ITT, that Mr. Allende becoming president and carrying out his policies would have a very serious effect on this country, as well as the business interests involved.
Nixon called Richard Helms and ordered him to proceed with this plot with the Chilean military to try to thwart the inauguration of Allende. And in my view, the CIA chief, Helms, would not have gone, just taken such an instruction without any discussion. That is to say, he must have said to the president, as I happen to know that he did, that he must have said to the president, yes, this is feasible. This is not impossible, as your ambassador is saying.
We, at this point, had begun to talk to the Kissinger office and the State Department about the what might happen when Dr. Allende was elected, if he was elected.
I sent two cables on September 27th and October 7th to the White House, to the 40 Committee, saying, and it went to the State Department's representative on that as well, the Undersecretary, saying that if anybody were thinking of a plot with the Chilean military, it would be, quote, a second Bay of Pigs. And the second of these two cables, I said I had discovered that the CIA had countermanded my specific orders and was meeting with representatives of a group called, or an extreme right-wing group called Patria y Libertad. They had been put off limits by me, as had the general with whom they were secretly plotting. Well, and I asked in that cable, what else might they be up to?
International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation, International Headquarters, October 16th, 1970. Personal and confidential. The armed forces boss, General Rene Schneider, is fully aware of the danger of Allende moving in, but he will not move an inch without Frey's okay. One retired General, Vio, is all gung-ho about moving immediately. Schneider has threatened to have Vio shot if he moves unilaterally. Unless there's a move by dissident Chilean military elements, Salvador Allende will be inaugurated as president November 4th.
I got an order to go right back to Washington and report to Kissinger on Monday, October 12th. And as when I went in to see Kissinger, and in the course of talking to him, said that only a madman would be dealing with this General Vio, the dissident general, or any Chilean military plotter. 30 seconds later, he leaped up and he said, would you like to see the president? Obviously, I didn't know that I had touched a very sensitive nerve when I said that only a madman would be plotting, since they were already plotting.
So this is Jen Gorlick. I'm an activist in D.C. I support a free and unoccupied Palestine, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas, your one true voice in Kansas, this is the Radio Free Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/hideincopfire.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of color organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice. End HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination. Get information from your community health center or nursing station, or visit www.caan.ca.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up.
this matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed, get tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
I'm so thirsty for revolution. I'm so crazy about the people. We're going to stand together. We're going to have a black army, a Mexican-American army, an alliance in solidarity. We're going to have some progressive whites, all of us. And we're going to march on this pig power structure, and we're going to say, stick them up, motherfucker. We come for what's ours. Up against the wall. Power to the people. Thanks, brother.
This is a message to the so-called New Black Panther Party, which resides in the United States of America. As an American citizen, I ask that you all immediately disband and stop what you are doing, which is misrepresenting an organization and a culture that you do not understand. As the child of a Black Panther, I was raised to understand that the ideals of a Black Panther shall live on. However, the physical representation of a Black Panther can and will be oftentimes misrepresented and imitated. These gentlemen are Black Panthers, and they also have the original mindset of a Black Panther, which is to ensure truth, justice, and equality for every single tax-paying American citizen, regardless of the color of their skin or their ethnicity. God bless you, and power to the people.
I'm Andrew Westmoreland. I'm a journalist, and we just, you know, we go out into the community, and we find stories that have national importance. You can follow me on Twitter at @DrewWest_press, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
It's our news flash.
No wonder there's been such an obscene growth in the Black Prosperity Church ministry. Study after study has shown that it will take a miracle for Black people in the United States to ever close the gap with whites in household wealth, that is, under the system of capitalism. The latest report on just how impossible that dream is titled The Ever-Growing Gap. It was conducted by the Institute for Policy Studies and the Corporation for Enterprise Development, both located in Washington. based on the steady erosion of black and Latino household wealth compared to whites over the past 30 years, the authors project that it would take 228 years into the middle of the 23rd century for black Americans to amass as much wealth as the median white household already possesses. Latinos are on a somewhat faster track. They'd become as wealthy as present-day white families in the year 2097. Only 27 years from now, in the year 2043, when the U.S. Census Bureau projects that blacks, Latinos, and other people of color will outnumber white Anglos in the United States, white households will already be a cool $1 million richer than black households, according to the new study. Diedrich Asante Muhammad was one of the numbers crunchers. He was also instrumental in a 2004 State of the Dream report that shocked and depressed black folks with a prediction that black parity in wealth with whites could not be achieved until the year 2099. This year's study projects it will take almost a century and a half longer than that just for black people to reach 2016 white wealth levels. A 2010 study out of Brandeis University issued the most honest assessment of long-term black economic prospects in the USA, concluding that African Americans will never gain wealth parity with Euro-Americans. The numbers speak